Welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. This is Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and in today's installment, we're going to be talking about something which certainly defines our cultural heritage here in Minnesota. It's the Mississippi River. In other Untold Stories, we've heard about the system of ferries which operated before bridges spanned the river, and we've also heard about the River's Edge Convention Center and how its 3D mural represents the wildlife in our area. But this time, we're going to talk about the state of the river itself. Today, I'm joined on the phone by Whitney Clark, Executive Director of the Friends of the Mississippi River, based in the Twin Cities. While the St. Cloud area doesn't necessarily have the nonprofit advocacy group that the Twin Cities does, the issues are similar, and the guidelines that they've set down and the ideas that they propose certainly apply to everyone who lives along the river.
Welcome to KVSC, Whitney.
Thank you.
Right.
Glad to be with you.
Now, Friends of the Mississippi River, this is a Twin Cities area nonprofit, but the river, well, it runs through St. Cloud and, you know, all the way down to New Orleans. So why don't you give us a little bit of history about the organization and what in particular do you guys do?
Friends of the Mississippi River is a 20-year-old nonprofit organization. Our mission is to protect and restore the health of the Mississippi River in the Twin Cities area. But in practice, what that means is we focus a lot on many statewide issues that impact the river. You know, the Mississippi River is the watershed or the area of land that drains to the Mississippi is about half of Minnesota. So we end up working on a lot of issues, statewide kind of policy issues, statewide issues that affect not just the Mississippi, but all of the state's waters. So a bit of history about Friends of the Mississippi River. Back in 1988, Congress designated a new national park. It's called the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area. It's a 72-mile linear park that runs from Dayton and Ramsey up in the North Metro all the way down to Hastings in the Southeast Metro. And it's the only national park that is dedicated to and focused on the Great Mississippi River, which is, of course, many people call it America's river. It's one of the great rivers of the world. It's a natural resource of global significance. It's a source of drinking water for more than 20 million Americans, including more than a million people in Minnesota. And so it's this really important but somewhat overlooked sometimes resource. And it flows through our major metropolitan area here in the Twin Cities. And so Congress saw the need to establish a park to celebrate and protect the resources here. And then founders of Friends of the Mississippi said, you know, it's not going to be enough just to have a park. There ought to be a citizen organization. There ought to be a nonprofit group that gets up every morning and says, you know, what needs to happen today to protect the river, to enhance the river, to improve the health and the viability and the vitality of this great river. So, of course, there are many decisions that are made every day, from individual decisions that you or I might make about something to do with our lawn or garden or our home, all the way to decision, official policy decisions that are made by the state legislature or a city council or something like that. And so our goal is to try to be present when those decisions are being made, especially the important ones, to bring a citizen voice and actually be a voice for the river itself, to speak up for the river and try to say, here's what the river needs in out of this decision.
Yeah, because it is one of those things. It is this dynamic thing. Well, how has the state of the river changed over the years? And, you know, we develop different technology in our culture. Sometimes that technology doesn't mix well with nature, and we don't realize it for a little while. And then we start seeing the effects, like through wildlife or, you know, through other things.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, how have you seen the river change over the years?
Well, that's a really good question, and you know, people have asked me this for years. You know, I go to a party, or I'm with the in-laws at holiday or whatever, and they'll ask me that question. So, how's the river? And I was always a bit at a loss for a good answer, because you know, there's a lot of ways to answer that question. And what we decided here at Friends of the Mississippi River is we ought to have some solid science-based answers to that question. So we decided to develop and create and write a report, a State of the River report. And we did that. We released it in late 2012, so it's been out for a year and a half or so. It is a science-based report. We brought together scientists who work on river or water quality or wildlife issues, and we asked them to help us develop indicators of river health. And indicators, we only wanted to use indicators for which there was solid record of scientific data. We didn't want to base it on opinion or
speculation.
Speculation. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, opinion or speculation for people who are smart observers can be pretty accurate. But we didn't want to rely on that. We wanted it to be really science-based. And so we selected 13 key indicators of river health, and they're all outlined in this State of the River report, which if your listeners are interested in learning more about it, they can find it at stateoftheriver.com. You can look at it online or download a PDF of the full report. But I can tell you a little bit about sort of the high points of what the report says. There's some good news and there's some bad news, I guess, is the way to characterize it broadly. We've made some good decisions and there's some improving trends. And one of them that people will appreciate right away, especially people who know the river, is bald eagles. Bald eagles on the Mississippi River, especially in the Twin Cities, are surging back to health. You know, there was a time in the late 60s, early 70s, where bald eagles were almost extirpated in the lower 48. I'm old enough so I remember back to that time. And if you saw a bald eagle, which you'd never see in the Twin Cities, but if you were up on vacation up in northern Minnesota or something when I was a kid, if we saw a bald eagle, it'd be like seeing a polar bear or a lion or something. It was really rare and special, and you took note of it. Now, this year, the National Park Service biologists have been tracking the success of bald eagles in the national park here. There are now 48 breeding pairs of bald eagles in the 72-mile national park corridor. That's up 25% from last spring. So really a great rebound. And of course, that is the result of federal legislation that was passed about 40 years ago banning DDT, which was a pesticide that was used very widely throughout the U.S. and had a terrible impact on bald eagle reproduction.
And that was mostly because of the runoff from everything gets into the river, and then it gets into the fish, and then the eagles eat the fish, and then that's when they had problems, correct?
That's right. That's right. The eagles are at the top of the food chain, and so some of these toxics in the environment do something that we call bioaccumulation. They build up, they get concentrated up the food chain. So each thing that eats another thing gets a more concentrated dose of these things. And eagles, because they're the top of the food chain, they were really severely hurt by this. And there are still some problems that eagles are facing. There's still lead in the environment from a number of sources. Lead can be debilitating for eagles. But the good news is we took decisive action back in the early 70s to address that problem, and it's taken a while, but eagles are coming back. Another example would be fish. Back in 1972, when Congress was considering the Clean Water Act, here in downtown St. Paul, where the river flows through St. Paul, there were no fish to be found in the sample nets that DNR biologists were collecting. There just simply wasn't enough dissolved oxygen in the river to support a fishery. And that's because the river was used essentially as an open sewer. It was full of sewage and toxic waste, and it wasn't a very fun place to be either. And so that's why many of the communities along the river kind of turned their back to the river. It was like the grungy back alley that you didn't want to spend much time there because it was stinky and polluted. Thankfully, the Clean Water Act was adopted by Congress in 1972, and it basically established a regulatory framework for water pollution. So, you know, it was no longer legal to just put pollution unfettered into our waterways, not just in the river, but this is federal legislation. It affected all the waters of the U.S. So the result of that is all these industries and wastewater treatment plants have had to limit their pollution to the waters, and they've done that. And so today, you can go down to the river in St. Paul, and you can catch a trophy walleye. There's a very healthy, fishery in the Mississippi River throughout the Twin Cities and north and south of it. It's a good assemblage and very good fishing. Up in your neck of the woods in the St. Cloud area, it's one of the best places in the whole country to fish for smallmouth bass. As you may know, people come from all around the country to fish for smallies in that part of the river up there. So another great success story. So there, you know, the lesson is, you know, the river and the environment in general is resilient. These ecosystems will heal themselves if you stop punishing them. That's sort of the good news. I said there was some good news and then some bad news. You want the bad news too?
Well, you might as well. Just to punctuate the good news, yeah, there are lots of people that fish along the Mississippi up here in St. Cloud. And I see people walking out with all sorts of fish, you know, constantly.
Yeah.
You know, it's they're there. I can see them, see the fish jumping around. I can see the eagles fishing as well, constantly. So, yeah definitely. It does seem that there is a sense of health in the river. You know, a long time ago, I was in New Orleans, and the river down there, that's at the very bottom of the river, and that looked pretty scary. But that's after the whole country is draining into it. So what we've got going on up here is certainly much healthier. However, yes, I imagine there is a flip side to that coin.
Yeah. Well, you know, you raise a good point that, you know, our neighbors downstream and in all the downstream states, they don't necessarily control their own water quality because the river arrives on their doorstep polluted. But we can't say that in Minnesota. You know, it starts here. We're the headwater state. It starts clean and clear at Lake Itasca. And by the time it leaves our borders, all the pollution that's in the river came from Minnesota. We've got, I think, a special responsibility to do our best to try to protect that. There are some trends that are not favorable, water quality trends especially. Some of the indicators in our report are things like sediment, which is small bits of soil particles that are in the water, nitrates and phosphorus, which are nutrients, excess nutrients, which, you know, sounds like nutrients should be good, right? We all need nutrients, and ecosystems do too, but if there's too much, then it gets out of balance and it creates problems, and that's one of the things that's happening in the Mississippi River.
Oh, yeah, balance is the key there.
Yep.
You have too much of one thing, and then everything else suffers.
Exactly. Yep. And, you know, another one, bacteria, which affects the swimmability and usability from a recreational standpoint. So those are some of the negative trends. There are also a number of emerging contaminants of concern. One of them that we just learned about in the process of doing the State of the River report is something called triclosan. Some of your listeners will be familiar with this because it's been in the news quite a bit lately. When we were sitting down to do this report, I mentioned that we brought together scientists from different disciplines who were knowledgeable about the river and different trends. And one of them said, we need to take a look at, there's some new published reports about this chemical. It's actually a registered pesticide called triclosan, that they're finding extremely high levels of this building up in the bottom sediment in Lake Pepin, which is just downstream from the Twin Cities. Triclosan is an antibacterial agent. It's an ingredient that's added to many, many different consumer products, especially like hand soaps and body washes, deodorants, lotions. It's also added to solid products like cutting boards and laundry baskets and carpet.
You know, those things that you would not want bacteria to build up on, of course, yeah.
Right. Right. I think, you know, manufacturers, companies that make these products are looking for every advantage they can, of course. And so if they can make a claim that their product is antibacterial, well, maybe that gives it a little edge at the point of purchase. Maybe that's why the person reaches for their product instead of the product right next to it on the shelf that doesn't say antibacterial. Because who doesn't want to get rid of bacteria, right?
And keep your
family healthy. Well, as it turns out, you were talking about sort of these unintended consequences of technology, and this is one of them. Triclosan, most of it, you know, when you think of washing your hands with an antibacterial soap that has triclosan in it, almost all of that triclosan goes down the drain, and it goes through the wastewater process, and it's unaffected by the wastewater process. It does not get taken out. And so it gets exposed to chlorine in the wastewater process. And then when it's put back into the river as part of the treated wastewater effluent, the water we put back in the river, it gets exposed to sunlight, where it becomes something called a dioxin. And dioxins are very potent carcinogens, and there's a whole family of them, but they're not good guys. They're bad guys, and they're building up at about 200 to 300% in Mississippi River sediments since the late 60s. These dioxins are known hormone disruptors. They affect the endocrine system of animals. They're known to affect muscle function in lab rats, and they're, as I said, they're carcinogens. And so we said, this is interesting. Not many people know about this. We want to report about this in the report, and we did. Got a lot of attention for this new data, which most people were not aware of. And as a result of that, then Friends of the Mississippi River led a two-year effort to ban the sale of consumer products containing triclosan in Minnesota. And I'm happy to report that just last month, the legislature passed a bill that does that, and the governor signed it last month. So we're excited. That's something that came directly out of this report. Starting in January of 2017, it will be illegal to sell cleaning products for consumer use in Minnesota that contain triclosan. So that's some good news, taking a problem and trying to make it a little bit better through passing legislation.
Oh, exactly. So you identify something that's going on, you do this science, and you report it, you get people to listen, and then all of a sudden you've made a difference. Who knows exactly what your organization has prevented in the future simply by identifying this?
Right.
You know,
right.
You look back at the bald eagles, you know, what was going on with that? How long did it take them to figure out what was going on? And then, you know, then they took steps. Now we can look at it as like, well, we don't know what's going to happen, but it's probably not good.
Right. Right. So. Exactly. Yep.
You're in tune to 88.1 FM KVSC. And this is the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. And today we're talking with Executive Director from the Friends of the Mississippi River, Whitney Clark.
Well, what are some of the things that people can do, just everyday folks can do that will assist the river, protect the river and the watersheds, and make our part of the Mississippi River, you know, nice and healthy, so that, you know, once it gets down to New Orleans and they complain about it in New Orleans, we could be like, hey, blame Iowa and Illinois.
Right, exactly. Yeah, well, that's a really good question, and I'm glad you asked it, because it can be hard for your average citizen to figure out how they can influence state legislature or Congress to do something. But we make decisions as consumers, as homeowners, as parents, every day that could be good for or not so good for the river and our waters. And so we actually, as a sort of a companion guide to the State of the River report, we released this stewardship guide. There's a policy guide, which is looking at the policy steps that could be taken, and there's a stewardship guide looking at what citizens can do to help the river. And that, again, I can mention some of the things in here, but that, like the State of the River report itself, it's available at stateoftheriver.com, so you can go there and download a copy of it and read what it has to say. But we haven't talked about pharmaceuticals and how those impact the river, but there are a number of pharmaceuticals or the byproducts of pharmaceuticals that get into the river, again, through the wastewater process, just like triclosan. And they get there primarily because people are told to take their pharmaceuticals, leftover unused ones, and flush them down the toilet. That is not good advice, and something that we don't want people to do anymore, because unfortunately those chemicals can be very disruptive to fish and wildlife when they get into the river. So that's one thing. Don't flush your pills. Most counties have solid waste recycling programs of some kind, so people should check with their household hazardous waste authorities in their county to figure out what the best way to get rid of their unused meds are. So that's one thing. So a number of things that people can do in their yard. So maintain a healthy lawn is an example. Install a rain barrel instead of having the water from your gutters and your downspouts flush immediately off of your property and into the storm sewer system, where it picks up, along the way, it picks up pollutants and carries it right to the river. Try to keep that water in your yard and filtrate it. Put it into a rain barrel where you can reuse it for watering your plants, or reroute it so that it can soak into the soil in your yard and work its way into the groundwater that way. There's another simple set of things that you can do. Raking, sweeping, and picking up your leaves and grass clippings and lawn chemicals after you applied them, if you apply fertilizer to your lawn, or don't apply fertilizer if your lawn doesn't need it. Pick up after your pet. Most people know this already, but if you've got a pet and you're out walking the dog, make sure you bring some bags to pick up after them. That pet waste gets washed into the river, where it creates bacteria pollution problems that we have. So those are just a few things that are highlighted in the stewardship guide.
Oh, yeah, just it's scrolling through it online. These are simple things, and a lot of it comes down to actually just being mindful and having manners. Just don't dump things that shouldn't be dumped.
Exactly.
Don't flush things that shouldn't be flushed. And some of this stuff we don't think about, but then once you point it out, you're like, oh, well, that makes sense. Those things make a difference, because once again, 20 million people live along the river. If everybody does that one little thing, then it really adds up. And that's on that negative side. But yet on the positive side, if everybody does one good thing, that adds up as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And if we can get more people to be thinking that way, it'll translate over time into a healthier river.
Very much so. So along those lines as well, if somebody wanted to get more involved with Friends of the Mississippi River, one, how would they get a hold of you? And two, what kind of volunteer opportunities does your organization have and various events that are coming up?
Glad you asked. This is a busy time of year for us, for volunteers. We do over 100 stewardship and educational events every year, and many of them, not all of them though, are during the warm months, June and July. I'm teasing. The warm months between April and October. But we
really
do,
teasing? I don't think so. It's still kind of chilly up here.
Yeah, I know. The way that people can find out about that and plug into these various things is to go to our website, first of all, which is fmr.org, as in Friends of the Mississippi River.org. There they can find the calendar of events that we've got going. So there are dozens of volunteer events that are planned for the summer and fall that we're still looking for volunteers for. It's things like river cleanups, cutting buckthorn at natural area sites. We do a lot of work restoring the native plant communities at important open space and parks along the river, and that takes a lot of volunteer muscle. So getting out and collecting prairie flowers or planting oak trees or pulling garlic mustard, various invasive species that choke out some of our beneficial native species. These are activities that we use, you know, hundreds and hundreds of volunteers every year to do. So whatever is the right kind of event that fits your interest, we've got a lot of things people can look at there. You can also sign up for our electronic newsletter, the Mississippi Messages, which comes out once a month and contains all sorts of news and action alerts about ways that people can get involved, or just reading about the river and learning about things that are happening along the river. So definitely the website, fmr.org, is a great way to do it. Of course, if you aren't online, you can feel free to call us. We're here in the Twin Cities. 651-222-2193 is the phone number.
Nice. Yeah, I've dealt with buckthorn before on some of my friend's property. And once it's gone, the rest of the foliage comes back. It's kind of nice. So
yes, that's right. You got to keep at it for a few years, but eventually you can get the upper hand. And yeah, if we don't, you know, many of our natural areas are infested with buckthorn. And if we let it continue to grow, eventually when the native tree species that are growing there die out or are blown down, we'll just have a buckthorn thicket left where our beautiful oak forest or basswood or maple forest used to be. You know, buckthorn it's a shrub. You know, it grows 15 or 20 feet high. It's got thorns on it, and it grows really thick. So it's not like a forest that you can amble through with your children. It's a dense thicket. And so it also doesn't have anywhere near the same ecological habitat value as our native forest species. And so a lot of reasons to keep our natural areas clear of buckthorn.
And then finally, Whitney, what are some of the other major challenges facing the river today?
Our State of the River report does identify a number of pollutants in the river, negative trends that are primarily the result of agricultural land uses. Minnesota is a major agricultural state, of course, and one of our key tributaries to the Mississippi River, the Minnesota River, is the primary delivery method for pollutants from agricultural land uses to get into the Mississippi River. There are many other agricultural watersheds in the state, too, but unfortunately, the approach that we have taken to agriculture is to rely upon voluntary methods to control and manage that pollution. As a consequence, we have massively polluted waters. So things like sediment, nitrogen, phosphorus are some of our primary agricultural pollutants that are really on the decline. They're making the health of the river much worse. And unfortunately, we don't have any kind of laws or rules that address agricultural pollution yet. When the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972, it regulated all the other sectors. So the energy sector, the manufacturing sector, wastewater treatment plants, cities, the mining sector, all these industries came under regulatory authority in the United States. Agriculture was exempted, and as a result, we're sort of seeing the burgeoning problem with more and more agricultural pollution getting into our waters.
Yeah, it is kind of odd how they kind of separated that out, but in a political way, it makes sense, but, you know, the river doesn't care about politics.
That's right. And, you know, the result of the Clean Water Act was all these good things. You know, the river is a lot cleaner as a result of that. But unfortunately, our number one source of pollution to the river now is agriculture, and we don't have an effective approach to addressing that yet. And so this is one of the things that Friends of the Mississippi River is working on, is to try to find ways to address this. And to be clear, we don't believe that it's farmers' fault that our river is polluted from agriculture. This is a systemic problem that's the result of farm policy in the United States. And until we have a systemic solution, we're not going to solve this problem. And so it's not about blame the farmers. They're trying to, you know, do the best they can, most of them. We need to help them to be the best stewards of our water quality that they can be. We need to start asking for stronger, more effective policies to address this problem.
Yeah, it's definitely a very complex situation when it comes to agriculture. Get into the genetically modified foods and, you know, seed and stuff like that. What is that doing? People are growing the food the way that they know how. So as technology evolves, then we need to keep imagining new ways of making it evolve so that it can have less of a negative impact. And yet we can still all eat. So.
Right. And this, you know, this, it's not as if we don't know how we would do this or we don't have any idea how farming could be viable without polluting. It's well understood how you would do it physically. It's not like we can't find the cure for cancer. We haven't figured out the technology yet. We have all the technology. We have all the knowledge we need. What we have lacked is the public awareness and frankly, the political will to get this done. So we'll keep working on that. That's one of the big priorities of Friends of the Mississippi River, is to try to address this problem and hopefully leave the river for our kids and our grandkids a little bit cleaner and a little bit healthier than when we found it.
Because the river was here before us, and it'll be here after us.
That's right.
Well, Whitney, thank you for talking with us today.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure, Jeff. I really appreciate you reaching out, and be happy to talk with you again. If you wanted to do more of this, be my pleasure to do it.
Once again, you've been listening to The Untold Stories of Central Minnesota, and we've been talking with Whitney Clark, Executive Director from the Friends of the Mississippi River, based in the Twin Cities. For more information on Friends of the Mississippi River, including volunteer activities and the State of the River Report, which won the Environmental Initiative Award for 2014, you can find it online at their website at www.fmr.org. This has been Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and The Untold Stories of Central Minnesota is made possible by funding through the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of AMPERS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's communities.